From the studios of KPCW in Park City, it's This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment and our connections with it. I'm Nell Larson.
And I'm Chris Cherniak. Well, you wouldn't know it by the temperatures, but today is the first day of fall. And as usual, on every solstice and equinox, Brian McInerney from the National Weather Service joins us to discuss all things weather and climate.
That's right. He'll share with us his thoughts on just how warm or not this past summer was for us here in Park City and Utah as a whole. He'll also talk about the rain we received, particularly that incredible storm the southern part of the state experienced a couple of weeks ago that washed out portions of I-15.
That's right. That's all in the first part of the show. Then in the second half, Nell will share with us her experience attending the Climate March in New York City. It's not enough. You couldn't attend the one in Salt Lake. You had to go to New York City.
I was already back there.
On assignment. So how exciting or exhilarating was it? Or like every other event in New York City, was it just one giant hassle? That's what I experienced living there.
I'll report on that.
All right. All of that and some news about the University of California deciding, Cal Berkeley in particular, deciding not to divest their fossil fuel portfolio. We'll talk about why they made that decision and what other universities are deciding to come around to begin to divest in fossil fuels, including the Rockefeller Foundation. Our connections with and impacts upon the environment. That's what This Green Earth is all about. And it all gets started right after these words from our underwriters. Stay tuned.
I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
I'm Tim Henney. Join us Wednesday at 9 a.m. for The Mountain Life.
We'll talk with the experts on health, nutrition, and fitness.
From celebrating the solstice to finding balance in your work, play, and relationships.
From detoxing your diet to intensifying your immunity.
From cartilage restoration to joint resurfacing.
That's Wednesday at 9 a.m. on The Mountain Life. Brought to you by
Park City Clinic,
Stein Erickson Lodge and Spa,
Grand Valley Bank and Heber Valley Bank,
Park Meadows Country Club,
and Vento Pizzeria.
Come celebrate All Thanks Summit County at the 5th Annual Harvest Festival, Saturday, October 4th, from noon till 5 at the High Star Ranch in Camas. Enjoy local foods, Utah craft beers, kids' activities, and over 30 local vendors. Featuring live music from Shane Jackman, Small House Strings, and Shea Zuro. Presented by KPCW supporters, the Uinta Headwaters RC&D Council, and Recycle Utah, your local nonprofit recycling center. More information at recycleutah.org.
This is Steve Roney with Berkshire Hathaway Home Services Utah Properties, formerly Prudential Utah. We continue to be proud supporters of KPCW and are excited to embark on the next era of Park City real estate under our new brand. More info at bhhsutah.com.
Welcome to This Green Earth, a weekly talk show on environmental issues and concepts of sustainability. I'm Chris Cherniak. She's Nell Larson across the board, back from being on assignment.
That's right.
All right, back east once again.
I was. I've been on assignment a few times lately.
Yeah, you have. You have.
Work gets in the way.
Thanks, as does fun
occasionally.
Well, welcome back, and you'll have some interesting stories to share with us about, like you say, the experience with the Climate March.
Yeah.
Huge event back there. Lots of things to talk about. But first, let's talk to Brian McInerney.
That's right.
It's fall. I hope I got that right. It's the first day of fall.
First day of fall.
And as always, you come here on every solstice and equinox.
Yeah.
To share with us the latest news, events, trends in the area of weather and climate. Two different things. And let's talk about what we've experienced since the last solstice, June.
Yeah.
How did we do this past summer, temperature-wise?
It was really a good summer if you were out and about and doing things. We were cooler than normal. Really? Precipitation during August was greater than 150% of normal across the board, across the state. And July was also much above normal throughout most of the state, and it was cooler. And that was really a welcome sight, because to have those continually hot summers kind of beats people down. And this was nice. You had rain. We had cooler temperatures. The vegetation did quite well. And it was really nice. But the question was, did this help our water supply? And really, it didn't help all that much. Summertime precipitation, we really don't factor into water supply, because for the most part, evaporates. It goes into the upper layers of the soil and evaporates off. And the plants transpire it out through their leaves. And it just goes away. Where it does help, though, is people don't use their sprinklers as much. And that's nice that they don't take it out of the reservoir. So the more precipitation we have that benefit of not using irrigation water, and that's what we saw. The other end of this is when we really needed a cool, wet weather pattern was during the spring months, and we just didn't get it. It was warm, it was dry, and that makes our spring snowmelt runoff very inefficient. We lose it, it evaporates, it goes away. And we could have done much better when we really needed it if we had a very cool, wet, rainy spring, but we didn't, and our inflow into the reservoir suffered as a result.
Okay. Well, Brian, you just answered eight of my questions. So
So we're done. Thank you for coming in.
Sorry about that.
So I was just going to comment on that sort of drier spring and wetter August, because our watershed committee was worried about stream levels. They were really low really early on in the summer, and we started to think, is this going to be one of those horrific years where East Gannon Creek dries up, stops flowing, fish die, et cetera, et cetera. But those rains in August, while they didn't improve our water supply or probably even much like groundwater storage, did do a lot for the local streams in that way.
Yeah, and you'd see that. It would be a really good rain event during the nighttime hours. And then, you go walk your dog and you'd see the streams, and they were elevated and they were a little muddy, which was nice to see. And it did. It kept the waterways in healthier condition than that horrific year we had where East Canyon Creek just dried up. And that was pretty bad. That was rough. And we haven't had that in a while. And it's nice to see. Last summer we had a good monsoonal flow, which did what we're just talking about. And then this summer we've had it also, which was really, really nice to see.
Yeah.
Okay.
Absolutely. So we also wanted to do a little bit of myth busting on the show today, talking about some of the predictions coming up for precipitation this fall and winter. And there's a map that's being passed around on social media nonstop talking about the precipitation this winter. And it may or may not be real.
Yeah, I'm not sure where that comes from, but it's kind of like an onion kind of thing. If you've ever seen The Onion, it's satire.
Right.
And the map just shows record-breaking snow anticipated throughout almost the entire country except for the fringes. And I think people in the West are latching on to that.
Like, really?
It's going to be a great ski season, and this is going to be fabulous, and
where did you see it?
Right.
I haven't seen it.
I've seen it on social media myself.
I've seen it on social media as well from some of the, actually outdoor and environmental and advocacy groups in Utah that are thinking this will be great. Look at all this precipitation.
It looks real. It's a
real enough. Real enough that when you glance at it, you think, oh, okay, where do we fall in this? All right, so we're going to get above average,
Not true.
Not true. So be wary of this map that you see. There are other maps out there for longer-term predictions.
Yeah.
All right.
And do you want to talk about El Nino now? Is that a good idea?
No.
Okay.
Sorry. Not yet.
All right.
No, we'll get to that in a few minutes.
Sorry, I'm jumping.
We're only
all
5 minutes into this. We got a little more time.
Okay.
I just want to summarize and what you said initially is that so this past summer here, locally, regionally, say a little cooler than normal. Mm-hmm. We had very few record high days. Where back in, I remember last year we had record high temperatures day after day after day, particularly in July. But this summer a little cooler than normal, which was a nice break, and a little wetter than normal.
Yeah.
So a nice relief. And so, like you said, I chuckled when you said we didn't have to water our lawns as much. I laughed because if you live at my place behind the Racquet Club, it's like Seattle. It's they water every. In fact, yes, Sunday it
just
rained.
Just 24-hour misting on your property.
It's just, they don't care. It rained most of the day Sunday. Remember, it was for roughly from 9 to 3, showers off and on. 7 o'clock at night, just like right on cue. Every day, sprinklers come on. It's all so. Yes, for most of us who recognize and do a good job at managing irrigation, we could maybe not irrigate as much. But, you know, we're trying to recreate a rainforest in my at the Raka Club, and we're doing a pretty
Pacific
good job.
Northwest, right here.
More mushrooms there than any year, although there's more mushrooms everywhere. Because of that.
Yeah.
Wetter, cooler conditions.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Okay. So, but let's talk about that huge storm event that occurred down in the southern part of the state. It might have been a remnant of Tropical Storm Odile that washed out I-15. Was that a good event? Are there some rain events that you think are good but don't necessarily play the role that they should?
Yeah, so if you looked at it by the meteorology maps, the models that show, that hurricane moved up Baja and then it moved inland. And then it started to fall apart. But what it brings is this copious amounts of moisture, you know, phenomenal moisture that goes all the way down to the ground and all the way very high in the atmosphere. So you don't have any dry layers where precipitation evaporates. And then it was interacted upon by a cold front, a wide-scale cold front that moved in off of the Pacific. And so think of a cold front wave that comes across, hits all this moisture, and makes it rise and produce thunderstorms that were producing 8 to 9 inches of precipitation down near Las Vegas. It washed out I-15. It caused havoc all over the place. And they had some horrific videos of vans being washed off of I-15 while they were sitting there, pushed into the median, and then floated backwards and then deposited underneath the highway. And this went on all over the place. They had widespread flooding. They had widespread damage. And this moved into Utah. And we had flooding in St. George, Santa Clara, Washington City, and then almost all of the slot canyons, dry washes, and the rivers themselves, the Virgin River systems, were all in flood. And what was nice as far as the weather service went, when you have a hurricane coming, you can get an early jump on these things and tell the people this is coming. And that's pretty much what happened. And then that moved out, and then we went back to a little more monsoonal flow as that came up, and we put down widespread precipitation across the state. You don't like to see the floods where people get killed and things are damaged, and that's just what happened. And then when you say, well, how did that affect our water supply? Well, it ran off for the most part.
Right.
It just kind of goes away. It goes into Lake Mead, which is nice, but the deficit of Lake Mead is such that this was just a drop in the bucket. We did have an event in 2006, though, in southeast Utah that produced so much rain and such widespread rain events over a 72-hour period that it rose Lake Powell 5 feet just from this storm.
Wow.
And so that was great. But those are few and far between.
Yeah.
And again, it caused havoc in southeast Utah. All the roads were washed out. Nobody died. But it was quite an event. And it rose Lake Powell 5 feet.
Wow.
And we've even felt this storm up here in Park City. Yeah. We had heavy rain. Mm-hmm. Did our local reservoirs go up at all?
No, unfortunately not. If you look at our reservoirs in the Provo system, Jordanelle, Deer Creek, they're doing better than the Weber system. We're actually part of the Weber Basin here. We're in the headwaters. And they're less than 50% on average through most of the system. And all you have to do is just drive by Echo and Rockport. East Canyon, they're well below 50% capacity at this time. If you look at Jordanelle and Deer Creek, they're like 65, 69%. So they continue to do better.
For this time of year?
Typically, you want to have a reservoir that draws down a little bit above normal right about now.
Okay.
So they're doing a little bit better. But we're on the third year of below average runoff, so you would anticipate these reservoirs to be quite low like we see in the Weber. But the way I understand it is the farmers only received 50% of their allocation out of the Provo River Water Users Group. So they got cut back, but as a result, the storage is still pretty good. Weber River basins, though, they're not doing so well, and they need a really good year this year.
And where is most of that water going? Is it agriculture? Is it culinary water? Is it
agriculture? 87% roughly of our water supply goes to agricultural use. They're irrigating farmers' fields. When you look at the water picture in total, 87% is used by agriculture.
In the Weber River system?
In the state of Utah.
In the state, okay.
You know, if you look at that.
And am I correct that most of that goes to growing alfalfa?
I think for the most part, but there's other crops involved.
Yes.
But I think.
But anyway, most of it to agriculture and my grass.
Right.
Behind the Racquet Club.
And the Racquet Club.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
So agriculture.
And then a little pie.
I can see the pie chart.
Of the pie.
Yeah.
For Racquet Club. No one knows what that is, but I get it. All right, let's take a break for a couple underwriters. And when we come back, we'll continue the conversation with Brian McInerney from National Weather Service. And we will talk a little bit about El Nino, a recent study that suggests that some of the warming occurred on the West Coast is actually natural. In its basis, and Park City may be getting a weather station. And how did that happen? Stay tuned. It's This Green Earth.
This is Dana Edwards on behalf of Vail Resorts and Cannons Resort supporting KPCW. This year, we developed partnerships with 25 local nonprofits to support programs like the fourth grade program at Swanner Preserve and Eco Center. Every fourth grader in Summit County will experience Utah's ecosystem firsthand and see science come to life through infield classes. Thanks to Swanner for making science cool.
This is Reese DeMille with Republic Services, your local recycling and garbage service provider and a proud sponsor of KPCW. Summit County residents are recycling more and more each year in their residential curbside recycling bin. Please help by putting acceptable recyclables in and keeping glass out. Thank you, Summit County. SummitCountyRecycles.org.
This is Kelly Miller at Assemble. We are thrilled to be a first-time KPCW underwriter. Assemble offers executive offices that may be rented on a short or long-term basis and an alternative to your local coffee shop in our business lounge. 435-709-7888 or on the web at assembleparkcity.com.
Welcome back to This Green Earth, weekly talk show on environmental issues, concepts of sustainability. She's Nell Larson, back from assignment in New York City. I'm Chris Cherniak. With us in the studio is Brian McInerney from the National Weather Service, senior hydrologist there. He joins us four times a year to talk about things, all things weather and climate. Hey, Brian, I want to just summarize some latest data from the National Climatic Data Center. Here it is. You ready?
Ready.
August 2014 and the June through August Northern Hemisphere summer period of 2014 were Earth's warmest since records began in 1880. Now, this is from, like I say, NOAA's National Climatic Data Center, a well-respected source of science and information. Would you agree with that?
Yeah. Okay. That's where our data goes to.
Okay. NASA, also another institution that follows the weather, also rated August 2014 as the warmest August on record. Again, this is globally.
Yeah.
Okay. August is the third time NOAA has ranked a 2014 month as the warmest on record. May and June were also, and April came in second or so. So if this trend continues, if 2014 maintains these temperature departures for the remainder of the year, 2014 will be the warmest year on record. And I would go out on a limb and say that so far this month of September, at least here, this has been a pretty above average month, would you say? Did you get a chance to look at the temperatures? I know last week, a couple of days down in Salt Lake City, the highs were either equal to records or even broke a record. And in a couple of days or so, temperatures are supposed to be back up in the middle upper 80s down in Salt Lake. So this is a pretty warm September.
Yeah, it's warmer and drier also.
Yeah.
So we're kind of back into that pattern. The monsoon is, the flow has stopped, and now we're back into that warmer pattern with less precipitation. There's some areas that were above just by some of the storms and the rain we had. But, and this is when we really start needing a lot of rainfall to saturate the soils as much as possible before we get snow. So it's not a dry sponge on top of snowpack. We have a very wet sponge. And then when the snow starts to melt, you get more in the reservoirs then.
Well, I also saw that the five-day forecast or so suggests that this coming weekend we're going to have a fairly beefy front come through with potential for snow at higher elevations.
Yeah.
So, but that's what happens at the end of September, beginning of October.
Yeah, it's not uncommon.
Okay. All right, but let's talk a little bit about some of the more global conditions and issues. You wanted to mention El Nino. You always mention El Nino.
Yeah, and that's the reason why we talk about El Nino is that we can predict weather 5 days, maybe 7 days out, and after that, the process falls apart.
Right.
Trying to quantify the atmosphere, there's too many variables. So how do you figure out what's going on in the near future? And last February, the forecast came out from the people that do the forecasting for El Nino, La Nina, the equatorial Pacific. And if we would have had a forecast, and we look like we were going to, of a very strong El Nino event, for southern Utah and the desert southwest, that's very favorable. They get cooler, they get wetter, and they need a lot of precipitation to make up this deficit. Northern Utah, not so much, because we're in between the two climate regimes of the Pacific Northwest and the desert southwest. But for southern Utah, this was going to bode quite well. Hmm. And as the process continued, the forecast kept diminishing. Then they thought maybe they're in a moderate event. Well, now it looks like we're in a weak event. And that was unfortunate because a strong El Nino has a good signature for a cooler, wetter desert southwest. Hmm. And now it looks like we're into a weak event, which could mean much of anything. There's very little correlation between weak El Nino events and a specific weather pattern that's going to set up. And that's unfortunate. Because when you look at southern Utah in the wintertime, their main storminess stopped in early December last year. They did not receive any major storm activity throughout the entire winter. And as a result, their water supply conditions were very, very bad.
Right.
We were much better up here, but they weren't so good down there.
I remember we covered a story on water supplies and, various towns were saying we're literally, 37 days out from running out of water kind of thing, like extreme measures.
Yeah. And it's pretty scary when you think of you could run out of water for some of the more isolated, smaller towns. We're just not used to this. Our infrastructure is set up so well that we really don't have to look at this scenario. And after 3 years and very hot conditions in some of these small towns, they have to kind of reconsider what they're using their water for.
Okay. Well, here, along those lines, talking about, again, more El Nino and large global activities, there is a study that just came out from NOAA. Some researchers found that with respect to the warming trends that are going along on the West Coast, that those trends are more a function of natural variability and less so of human activity. And specifically, I'll quote the article out of this morning's LA Times. The study found that weakening winds accounted for more than 80% of the warming trend along the Pacific Northwest coast between Washington and Northern California, while in Southern California, the same weaker winds were responsible for about 60% of the increased warming. So, that's okay. You have lots of conditions there that can affect temperature.
Yeah, I think what that is that nasty high pressure that sets up for the last 3 years, and really California's had more extensive problems with this. There's a weather feature that sets up right around October, and we've had it the last 3 years, and it affects Utah dramatically, but it really affects California. It's the main reason why they're in a drought. So think of a bubble of energy that just parks over the West Coast and the West in general, and it shunts all of the storms north and a little bit south, so you really don't get storminess. You don't get moisture, winds, and those types of things. You get high pressure, which is characterized by sunny days and very little winds. And this has been the weather feature that's really messed with our water supply throughout the West. And again, this is what we don't want to see setting up in early October. So if you happen to be noticing or watching TV weather and you see that big H over California over an extended period of time, this is the weather feature that calls for below average precipitation. And we don't want to see that. What we want to see is zonal flow, storms coming from the west, the Pacific Northwest, and maybe the Southwest. Early on, you want to see them come out of the near Alaska because they're cold. It kind of freezes up the ground, and we get more snow that lasts as opposed to rain events. So storms out of the Pacific Northwest are what we're looking for. Out of the west during the winter because they're mostly very wet storms, and then even out of the southwest. They're a little warmer, but you can still have really heavy snow with those types of events.
Okay.
So is this high pressure that sets up over the west and over California, is this something that, you know, has been seen in the past for a series of years? Is it something relatively new, you know? Why is that happening?
It's if you look at a global map of weather conditions, there are typical places where these high pressures set up and low pressures set up. And then the jet stream oscillates like a sine wave around the globe in the northern hemisphere and the southern hemisphere. What we're seeing lately, though, is that its magnitude is much bigger. At one point last year, during early, right before we had the storms, it was January, the high pressure extended all the way up to Alaska and almost down to the equator. So when you think of any weather coming off of the Pacific, it hits this high pressure, and then you see the flow just go up over the top of Alaska, and then it dropped down to the upper Green River Basin and then into the Colorado area. And they did quite well as far as water supply because they had the flow that came down over this high.
Right.
We were shut out for the most part, and California was shut out just about all of the winter time. They never really saw a break for the most part. And so when you look at it, we've had this before. It just seems to be enhanced and hasn't moved very much in the last 3 years.
So that high pressure influences the jet stream.
Yeah.
It's not the jet stream that influences the high pressure. It's the high pressure that moves the jet stream.
Yeah. It's the jet stream is trying to, well, it's just taking its normal flow of least resistance. That high pressure sets up. The jet stream hits it. It goes north. And it went all the way up to northern Alaska, then dropped down where it had the least resistance due to the global flow of our air.
And then might that explain why, as I understand, Alaska had a very relatively warm and really wet winter last year,
with
a lot of rain,
and
that continues.
Right. And when you think of how we did in northern Utah, it was only like a two-week event, and a 4-day week event where the high broke down, and storms from Hawaii came directly across in early February, and we had up to 2 feet of water, not snow, but 2 feet of water in the Logan area. The farther south you went, it became less, but that's really what saved northern Utah's water supply, was this really 4 to 5 day event with a little messiness on the ends. If we didn't get that break in the high pressure, we would have looked like southern Utah, where our storminess didn't occur after December.
A little Pineapple Express?
Yeah.
Action, you know, thank you.
I think the term now is used as atmospheric river. I think that's the one. That's what I've heard.
Pineapple Express.
It's so much better.
It's way better.
It's
better. Easily
Jimmy
visualized.
Jimmy Buffett coming your
Pineapple
way.
Pineapple Express. Okay. So let's turn our attention to back to local conditions, because when you were here in June, we were talking about weather here in Park City and weather stations. In fact, there's weather stations all around here.
Yeah.
But right now in Park City, there is no weather station
Climate station.
Oh, a climate station.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. What's the difference?
Well, the climate station really is there, and it just collects data over a long period of time, and it's used in that fashion. We have lots of weather stations on the ski areas for snow avalanche conditions. But we use them in a short term, 2 days out, a day out, what happened overnight for the winds, for the avalanche conditions, and how cold was it. But we don't have a long-term record of how our weather is. Is it getting warmer? Is it getting drier? Is it getting cooler? Because we had a climate station. I was at the fire department, and then the firemen got tired of doing it because they do fire and not wet climate. And so they said they didn't want to do it. A couple of private people have taken it on, but they didn't want to do it. So we were looking for somewhere to place a climate station in Utah. And we did it on this show. And the ladies from the library were nice enough to call and say, would you like to put it in the library? And I was ecstatic. And we're in the process of doing that now.
Really? Okay. Yeah. And this is the new library.
Yeah. Well, we're going to put it at the Miners Hospital for the year until they get the new library figured out.
Okay.
And then we're going to move it. And it's
so it'll travel with the library.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's a direct result of this show.
Well.
There you go. Way to go.
Little pat on the back there.
We're
thanks,
done.
Thanks, Brian.
Can we maybe
let's go have breakfast somewhere.
Now?
Retire from the show.
So what is it going to record?
So what it'll do is take the high temperature and the low temperature every day and any precipitation that's measured. And the ladies at the library will go out every day and measure out of a can. It's just a can. And they're going to put a stick in there and see how much precipitation they got and then write it down. And then the temperature sensor is automated, so that will just record the high and the low every day. And then we'll start it running again to see how we're doing climatologically here in Park City.
So how long has the break been between the last station and this station?
I think we're about 12 years where we don't have data.
Wow.
Wow.
Where is the nearest climate station right now?
If you look, it's up over the hill in the Brighton area. There's a climate station over there.
Right.
Yeah.
But that's a completely different.
Yeah,
that's a completely different weather pattern. There.
Right.
So.
Well, thanks to the people at the library for taking us on.
Yeah, it was great. It was fabulous.
Adrian and her staff, fantastic. And of course, what they'll do, they'll probably get kids to help them go out and take, you know, turn it into an educational event.
I have to say though, they have to get approvals by the historic board before they can put a weather station up. And they have a few more procedural hoops to go through before they can get a yes. But they've tentatively said, this is a good idea. We're open for it. Let's now take it to the next step. I don't want to say we're actually going to do it. We're in the process.
And does the person doing it have to be certified or trained in any way? Or can they use it as a teaching experience?
They'll be trained by our climate person at the Weather Service on how to do this and where we're going to place it. Because you have to be away from the structure by so many feet so the heat of the building doesn't influence the temperature sensor, away from vegetation so it doesn't, you know, the trees don't block the precip, or away from sprinklers so the sprinklers don't mess up the data.
That's interesting, right.
Yeah. So there's all these things that are mandated by NOAA on a climate station that you have to do. And so we're working with the library people to find out the best location. And also, you know, with anything, you get vandalism, which is, you know, totally stupid, but it happens.
Sure.
Hopefully we won't have that here in Park City.
So it's not as simple as putting it, just throwing it up on the roof.
Yeah, you can't put it on the roof because the roof heats up, the building heats up, and you get a screwed up temperature. But if you put it in an area that is natural vegetation somewhat, and it's away from a building, you get a pretty good data set. And then we can compare it to what we had 12 years ago, and see how that goes, even if we could, because it has moved around a great deal.
Yeah.
And if it's below a certain elevation or it's near a certain location away from the last time you had it, then it's a new station and you can't compare the two records. Because the precipitation at my house out by the Blue Roof store is different from what we have here at the radio station. So it could be a new station record, but nonetheless, we're starting the process, and that's a good thing.
That is. That's great.
Yeah.
Good news. We need that.
Yeah.
And hopefully the library staff, you know, will be enthused that they'll want to continue. They won't call you a year later and say, hey, what?
You know, this is just time consuming.
We do books.
We do books.
But no, that's congratulations to that. I hope it comes through. Like you say, it's not a done deal yet. But we need that.
It seems so important for a community that's really so focused on the weather and on our snow and on our precipitation. We want to know what's happening here in our town.
And will it be available online?
Yes.
Where does that data go?
It goes to NCDC, the people you had just spoke of earlier.
Right.
And so what happens is it gets collected, and then our climate person at the Weather Service then takes all the data and sends it to NCDC, the National Climatic Data Center, where it's logged, and then you can get it if you need it online.
Actually, you can, because I go there, I'm doing some research, and they do have daily updates. So it will be tracked on a daily basis.
I mean, right now there's a weather station at the golf course that I collect the precip every month, but that doesn't have temperature. And we need something official that will give us the truth on what's going on. And that'd be great.
Okay. Great.
Fantastic.
Well, Brian, anything else? Anything else we left out?
I'm really glad you didn't ask me if this is going to be a big winner.
Yeah, we didn't ask you to look ahead.
I'm really glad you didn't ask me that.
No, we have that map.
We expect you to bring your crystal balls.
We have the fake map.
We have the fake map on social media to reference. It's
going to
be a huge winter.
Huge winter.
Just go with that. Just go with that. No, exactly. So
we can't make any predictions.
We've given
up. It's a weak system.
Asking you to forecast, Brian. We know that you every show you come on, you say, maybe 7 days is the farthest out you can predict with any level of confidence.
Right.
After that, the confidence level drops to near zero.
Right. And one thing to consider probability-wise is we've had three below-average years. Probability-wise, we're in for a normal to above-average year this year. So that's what I'm hanging my head on right now.
Okay. All right.
All right.
But you probably said the same thing last year when you said, well, we had 2 years below average, so we're in for an average year. But you never know. Every year is a new set.
Right.
It's a reset.
And our atmosphere is different than what it was before, so it behaves different because we have more greenhouse gases in there. It's a warmer atmosphere, so it behaves differently.
So
our
that's
storminess
why
is different. It has different characterizations. So
shifting normalities. I mean, who would think that a tropical storm winds would actually come up into Arizona? How often does that happen?
Okay.
I'm sure it's not deferred. But these are rare events. That was a powerful storm, Odile, that made its way up. And so maybe these are parts of the new normal. The hurricane season on the Eastern Pacific has been way above average, the number of hurricanes and tropical storms. Meanwhile, over in the Atlantic, it's been slightly below average and doesn't look like it's going to change much. But no one predicted these conditions.
Yeah.
They try. You guys do your best.
Yeah, you use the science, what's available. But like I said, 5 days, maybe 7 days. And then it just falls apart.
Don't trust those 10-day forecasts?
We certainly don't use them.
All right. Brian,
words of wisdom.
Brian McNair, as always, your website.
Weather.gov. Click on Utah, and you can get a forecast right for a little square right over your house.
Perfect. That's what I need to know. Well, my place, it's always
yours
wet.
Is different.
So it's the jungle.
It's microclimate over there.
Thank you. All right, Brian.
Thanks, Brian.
We'll see you in December.
Okay. Thanks for having me again.
You got it, man. Thanks. Right. Hey, let's take a little break for some underwriters. And when we come back, we'll continue the conversation in the climate vein.
We absolutely will.
Climate March. It's this green earth. Stay tuned.
Rocky Mountain Power is proud to support KPCW and this green earth. Rocky Mountain Power offers watt-smart advice such as avoiding the use of large appliances like a washer or dryer between 2 and 8 p.m. because it helps reduce energy demand and keeps costs down for all of us. More ways to save energy at wattsmart.com.
Come celebrate all things Summit County at the 5th Annual Harvest Festival, Saturday, October 4th, from noon till 5 at the High Star Ranch in Camas. Enjoy local foods, Utah craft beers, kids' activities, and over 30 local vendors. Featuring live music from Shane Jackman, Small House Strings, and Shay Zero. Presented by KPCW supporters, the Uinta Headwaters RC&D Council, and Recycle Utah, your local nonprofit recycling center. More information at recycleutah.org.
This is Steve Roney with Berkshire Hathaway Home Services Utah Properties, formerly Prudential Utah. We continue to be proud supporters of KPCW and are excited to embark on the next era of Park City real estate under our new brand. More info at bhhsutah.com.
Welcome back. to This Green Earth. I'm Nell Larson, and that's Chris Cherniak rocking out across the board. And I'm back from a trip.
Yeah.
From back east, yeah.
You went
back
to New York, among other places. You went to New York City, and you had the opportunity to attend or be part of the 400,000 strong or so.
That's right. Yeah, it was
the client New York.
It was
City
a very environmentally focused week. I started out with a Land Trust Alliance annual conference talking about land conservation, and from there I went to New York and attended the People's Climate March.
Okay. Well, you know, before we get to the march, what did you? What were the takeaways from the Land Trust?
So the Land Trust Alliance is like kind of the organization for land conservation. It's the, sort of like the, almost the like certifying or membership body for the land trust community. So it's, you know, a conference that has all kinds of different tracks and information.
Right.
And I always kind of do a mixture of land conservation, land management focused kinds of things. And
What are things like out here in Utah relative to other areas of the country? Does everybody face the same challenges or issues?
There are a lot of common issues and challenges. The land trust community, though, is huge in places like the Northeast and California. I mean, states have, you know, tens of land trusts, where in Utah we only have a couple of land trusts. And so we have a much smaller community here. So it's nice for those of us, you know, Utah Open Lands or Summit Land Conservancy or SWANR, to head to these things where you have a larger community to kind of learn from, compare notes with, compare experiences.
Okay.
So we're a small conservation community in this area in comparison to the rest of the country. Not a shocker.
Exactly. You took the words. Right.
But, you know, there are thousands of land trusts across the country.
Yeah. And their goal is
to
protect, conserve, preserve.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Like, for example, the Summit Land Conservancy's mission, or their vision statement, I guess, is we save land.
Mm-hmm.
And it's similar to the Land Trust Alliance, this sort of overarching body. Their mission is to protect the places that people love. So it's very simple, and those can be protected by, you know, purchasing and owning the land in fee simple, or those can be protected by placing a conservation easement on a piece of property that may remain private. The ownership may remain private,
right,
but you just take the development rights away from it. So there are a lot of different mechanisms that people use.
Okay. Well, I'll say this. Round Valley, I guess, is an example of an example of it? Well, I was out
it
there
is.
Last night. I've taken to this fall, instead of trail running or mountain biking, I just go out for walks at the end of the day, and it's usually pretty quiet.
Yeah,
I mean, it's really quiet as far as people go. But for the first time, when you're actually just out walking and just walking about, it's a completely different setting, because unlike running and riding, You don't hear nature.
Right.
You don't have an opportunity to experience it in a slower form.
Right.
And hear it and visualize it. And you know what? There's more birds around. You see more things.
Yeah.
There's deer right over there. Whereas
right.
if you're running or riding, you're just scaring everything away
right.
With your approach.
Right.
You know, they hear you.
They hear
so
you
first. So
it's
a completely different
set.
It was really nice. And of course, it's so quiet at the end of the day. And it's just a different experience.
It is, yeah. And those experiences are, I think, like why we preserve land. And in this community, it's especially important, because people often assume these places are public land. Because in the West, there's a lot of public land in general, but not here in our town. And even in our county. And so it's important that there are groups that are preserving land. Like
Absolutely.
Summit Land Conservancy, Utah
Thank
Open
you.
Land, SWANR. And then the city and the county obviously both do a ton of work on that front as well, to preserve those places that people love. So we still have access to them to recreate, but then also the benefits of water quality, wildlife, habitat, things like that.
Right.
You know, the other reasons we love to live here, right? Like
right.
we love to live here for those
important
reasons.
Watersheds.
Right. Exactly.
Okay. All right. So that was your experience, one, back east with that conference. But now the more fun element of your time there was participating in the march.
Yeah. So I trained up to New York City after the conference was done and met up with a few friends, and we decided to attend the People's Climate March, which was being billed as, you know, this is going to be the biggest march on climate change ever. And, you know, I think organizers didn't know how many people to expect. I saw in some places they were hoping for like 100,000.
Sure.
Well, somewhere between 310 and 400,000 people showed up for this event. It was a massive, massive group of people.
And that became a little troublesome.
Yeah. I mean, it was incredibly well organized, and it was a very sort of calm, comfortable atmosphere.
Really?
But
Kind of festive.
It was kind of festive. but the organizers ended up having to kind of like encouraging people to disperse in the mid-afternoon because there were so many people backed up along the march route.
That's what I read. Where did you start and where did you finish?
So we met up on the route started along the western side of Central Park. Yeah. And so we met up right in that area. And then
when did you actually start moving?
So I think that in our area, the march kind of started really moving around like 12:30, an hour after it started. Yeah.
It takes a while.
And then there were tons of people backed up behind. It was like, you know, 4 miles of people.
Yeah. That's what it was, a huge turnout.
Yeah.
And the turnout, you know, because people wanted to participate in this.
Yeah.
It's important.
It was incredible. One of the things that the organizers made happen, and I was shocked that this worked, is that at 12:58, everybody was supposed to go silent and sort of have 2 minutes of silence in the middle of New York City to, recognize the people that have been victims of climate change and sort of are dealing with the consequences right now. And the whole march was led. The first group was sort of like indigenous peoples, at-risk peoples who are living in these areas and seeing the impacts really intensively. Anyway, so there's these 2 minutes of silence, which is like eerie. I mean, it makes your hair stand on end in the middle of New York.
Right,
it was silent.
It got quiet.
Mm-hmm. And then the next piece is that at 1 p.m., the silence was to be broken by sounding the alarm. And this wave of sound kind of started from the back, and you could hear it coming. And then it kind of hit the location where you're standing. And, you know, people are like playing musical instruments and banging drums and just yelling. And it was really powerful. I had like never been to any kind of protest, I guess, before.
That's my experience. I have limited experience with that because I'm not a kind of a protest, march type of guy.
Yeah.
Did you, I don't know, I guess the point is to try to expose or bring to light the climate issues, and in the media, it got a lot of coverage in the media.
Exactly.
National media, international media. And that's the aim of this, to try to bring awareness that this is important. And the fact that so many people attended, far more than they anticipated, it really drives home the point that a lot of people are concerned about this issue.
Right. And the timing of this march in particular was planned around the United Nations Climate Summit, which is happening this week in New York. Obama will be there. The Secretary General of the UN, Ban Ki-moon, attended the march.
Did
along
you march with him?
No, I didn't.
The mayor?
But you know, you have the Bill Clinton, the Al Gores and Bill McKibbins and, you know, Jane Goodall and, I mean, Leonardo DiCaprio. I don't know. There was like a smattering of celebrities that got coverage. But mostly it was just kind of like ordinary people, and it was, you know, every group under the sun was represented, from, you know, college groups, environmental groups, school groups, ethnic groups, religious groups.
Right.
Environmental advocacy groups.
Right. Quite a diverse array.
An incredibly diverse group of people, you know, and there were like marching bands and dance groups. And
as an event, you were impressed by its magnitude. But for those events, you don't necessarily come away knowing any more. Or did you learn things about climate change that you didn't know? Or was it just more of a kind of event to galvanize?
Yeah.
Kind of a group effort?
I think it was more about galvanizing a group effort. I mean, it was cool to see all of those different kinds. You know, people are coming at the climate issue from every angle under the sun, whether it's like sustainable food or equality or whatever else. Mm-hmm. And just to have all those people in one place sort of working together brought a great energy, you know. Some people brought really funny, creative signs. Other people were very serious, you know, about the issues they were covering.
Okay. So. Well, there were climate marches all around the country, all around the world, too. Mm-hmm. There was a small one in Salt Lake City. So
yeah, there were 2,800 rallies in 166 countries.
Well, let's see what the UN can do this week.
Yeah.
Well, with its conversations about this issue.
Yeah. One of the interesting things that is being talked about, I think, more like yesterday and today, is how this march kind of matches up to the major marches in U.S. history as far as numbers of people. And it's right up there or, you know, kind of above a lot of the really major movements. So,
well, let's hope it serves a good purpose in educating, compelling those who are somewhat indifferent or denial or kind of denying it to one degree or another, that this means something to a lot of
good
people.
Pun.
And it has a lot of consequences associated. All right, let's take a break for a couple more underwriters. And we come back with a couple of calendar events, and it's time to wrap up. It's This Green Earth. Stay tuned.
Support for KPCW comes from Assemble, offering private offices in New Park. When the home office space is not enough to get the job done, amenities include high-speed internet, conference room space, 24/7 access, receptionist, executive locker room, and more. 435-709-7888 or on the web at assembleparkcity.com.
This is Dana Edwards on behalf of Vail Resorts and Canyons Resort supporting KPCW. This year, we developed partnerships with 25 local nonprofits to support programs like the fourth grade program at Swanner Preserve and Eco Center. Every fourth grader in Summit County will experience Utah's ecosystem firsthand and see science come to life through infield classes. Thanks to Swanner for making science cool.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided by Long Reimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, LRW-LAW.com. Park City Nursery. We know what grows. ParkCityNursery.com. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners like you.
Wrap up things on This Green Earth. But first, a couple of calendar of event items.
No? Yeah, coming up on September 27th is the Provo River Watershed Festival that's held at the Wasatch Mountain State Park in Midway at the Visitor Center there. And it's a really fun event. They really focus on sort of like hands-on activities, so great thing to bring family to or kids. Or if you're interested in getting some information about the watershed, it's 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. And it's free, and it's on National Public Lands Day. And so there's like geocaching, information about native wildlife. There's a birds of prey demonstration.
Bounce
you know
house.
Things about watersheds.
No bounce house.
Okay. Food concessions.
All right.
Tours of the historic Huber Grove, the old apple grove there.
Nice.
Native American dancing.
And where is that
all
again?
Kinds of things. This is at the Wasatch Mountain State Park in Midway.
Okay.
From 11 to 3 on September 27th.
Perfect. And the other one? Is there another calendar?
This is the one we want to focus on.
All right, that's
on
the
today.
One we got. Yeah. That's good. We have a minute to kind of wrap things up. First, thanks again to Brian McInerney from the National Weather Service sharing his usual expertise in all things weather and climate.
Thank you, Brian. Regular guest.
And let's thank our underwriters for whom this show would not be possible. They include Recycle Utah,
Republic Services,
Vail Resorts,
Rocky Mountain Power,
San Francisco Design,
and Berkshire Hathaway Home Services.
Of course, you can always join us or like us on Facebook and send us your ideas and thoughts. That's KPCW, This Green Earth.
You can email us your comments or ideas for future shows at thisgreenearth@kpcw.org.
Remember, this is KPCW 91.9 FM, Park City.
Only in Park City, only on KPCW.